Welcome to The Spectator Podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be discussing Britain's obesity crisis, the upcoming German elections, and the England team's footballing woes. First, Britain's obesity problem is worsening, says Prue Leith in her Spectator cover piece this week. The UK is the sixth fattest nation on earth, and more than a quarter of the population is obese. Yet despite this worrying epidemic, precious little is being done. It's time for drastic action, says Prue, who argues that we need to get over our view of government intervention as nannying. So how can we fix this crisis? Here with some answers are Spectator Health's Christopher Snowden, Professor Graham McGregor, Chairman of Action on Sugar, and Professor Francesco Rubino from King's College London. So in her cover piece this week, Prue Leith says that the fact that the six of the fattest nations, the US, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Ireland and the UK, all speak English, tells us something about our food culture. Professor Graham McGregor, do you think she's right about that?
Yes, I mean, it's the responsibility of the food industry. Food industries cause us to get fat, and we need to do something about the food industry because they're the ones causing that, and we need to control them.
What do you propose to control?
Well, we've proposed a whole raft of measures. I mean, we're faced by a real crisis in obesity, but the biggest crisis is actually a wider one. That is, the biggest cause of death and disability is now unhealthy food, and that comes from the global burden of disease. So it's not only obesity, it's type 2 diabetes, it's high blood pressure, it's high cholesterol, and so on. So we've got to tackle the whole issue, and the food industry is out of control and needs to be controlled.
Christopher Snowden, do you think that the food industry is out of control, or is it that people's eating habits are out of control?
Possibly some people's eating habits are out of control. Certainly people's sedentary lives are a big factor, and it's been one of the major changes over the last 40 years, is people just simply not moving around much, either at work or at home. But the food industry has never given us more choice. You know, there's about 40,000 products in an average supermarket. There are low-fat varieties of things, low-sugar varieties of things that just didn't exist 30 years ago. Even something like milk, for example. Most people had Gold Top in the 1970s.
Yeah, but wait a minute. The food industry sends billions on marketing rubbish to us, and 80% of those adverts are marketing for unhealthy food. So they're selling it to these gullible people. It's all right for people like ourselves who can not read, you know, get away from the message, but for poorer people, they fall for it and buy this rubbish.
I don't endorse the idea that poor people are gullible. I don't endorse this idea that we're in some little ivory tower. We all know better, and none of us are obese. But the masses out there get swayed by advertising. I just don't accept it.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. And the food, who's spending that money? The food industry, and it's all unhealthy food. So it's no point in saying it's a choice when, in fact, the food industry market and advertise brilliant internet games to young children, as you know, to sell this rubbish. And it's not healthy food they're trying to market because they don't make so much money on it.
Francesco, do you believe that the government needs to intervene more in the food industry and in educating people about what the food industry is trying to sell them?
Well, I do believe that education is key, and I think one of the good things governments could do is to improve education of the public about the risks of obesity, of course, but I think that has been done for a while. What we need to do in terms of education now is to educate people to the fact that this is not an individual responsibility. There is much that is causing the epidemic that is beyond the control of a single individual. So we should not blame obese patients for being obese, but can understand that there is biology behind that that has become dysfunctional because perhaps of exposure to some of the modern type of foods that we have today.
But even if you're not sort of blaming or judging or shaming people for being obese, presumably there are a series of choices that are being made that may lead to obesity in terms of diet.
Inevitably, some choices can predispose you to risk of increase the risk of getting obese. But I would make an analogy with cancer. I mean, you can get cancer from smoking, but you can get cancer also because of exposure to pollution. I mean, pollution in cities are way beyond the reach of individual actions. I think that requires government actions to tackle, and I think the same goes with obesity. You've seen an epidemic of obesity not just in the English speaking nations. We are the ones that have the highest prevalence at the moment, but the rise in obesity is even greater in non English speaking nations, suggesting again that something has changed the past 20 years, and everything points to a change in the way we manufacture food. I'm not sure whether it's just a simple issue such as how much sugar or how much other issues, other things that are in modern food or some chemicals that are used as preservative. We don't have the science. It's very accurate to say what the problem is, but the problem is certainly coming from modern food, and it's across the board, it's not just English nations.
Christopher, you don't like the idea of saying that poor people are too gullible to realise that they're eating junk that's making them unhealthy, but do you think that there is a general lack of awareness across the population about what is in what we are putting in our mouths?
I think there could be, and I think one of the few good things about the current crusade against sugar is it's educated people about how much sugar there is in fizzy drinks. I suspect that lots of people didn't know quite how much sugar is in a can of Coke, for example. It's a shame, I think, that that wasn't put in terms of calories rather than teaspoons of sugar. I don't like this idea that a teaspoon of sugar is some kind of unit of harm. But yeah, it may well be people don't know how many calories there are in fizzy drinks. It may well be the people don't know how many calories there are in a pint of beer or a glass of wine. And I'm absolutely in favour of having those things shown on the products. But what I do disagree with is the point we just heard, which I think is a sleight of hand, to compare the food environment with industrial pollution. If you have industrial pollution, and yes, you do need the government to act because no individual can deal with that problem themselves. So it's one of those genuine public health problems which does require collective action. Obesity is totally different to that. It's entirely a private problem. It's due to the things that you do privately, either lack of exercise or eating too much. It is not some contagion in the environment that needs a government to act.
Graham McGregor,
well,
I
totally disagree with that. Let's give you an example. If you take a McDonald's hamburger, chips, Coca-Cola, that would have to run, a child would have to run half a marathon to burn it off, so exercise is not important in it, and it's equivalent to 18 oranges. Now, I could go out now and eat that, and we could have lunch later on, but you eat 18 oranges now, and you won't eat for 2 days. That's the difference. This very cheap junk food has no feeling of satiation. It's stuffed with calories. You don't feel full, and people eat and drink more and more sugar sweetened drinks, and that's why they're getting fat, because of the type of foods that the food industry is selling to them, because the biggest profits are on these very cheap, high fat, high salt, high sugar foods. It's elementary. You don't need to have a PhD in nutrition to decide why people are getting fat. They're eating food that gives you no feeling of satiation, that's stuffed with calories.
It also does taste quite nice, doesn't it? Which is
well, it's very carefully manipulated by the foods. You have the right salt, sugar, and fat levels, and people.
That's what cooking is, by the way.
Well, it isn't. I don't agree.
Jamie Oliver is exactly the same thing, and his burgers and chips have about the same number of calories as McDonald's. This again is pure snobbery.
You doesn't. I don't agree with that at all. You actually change the taste. Receptors, there's very good evidence that if you eat a lot of salt, you need more salt to get a salty taste, a concentration. Same for sugar. So you in fact get people addicted or habituated to these very high sugar, high salt foods, and then when mum cooks a really nice, wholesome meal that you have every evening, I know, at home, Chris, they say, oh, it's not salty enough, it's not like the McDonald's hamburger, it's not enough salt in it, I want the chips, People get addicted to these foods. That's the problem.
And
the
there food is no knows such it. Thing as addiction.
To habituation. They like they get they get the they thing, get so they like very high salt, high sugar foods, and you see that now.
But what you still you acted as if you were going to answer my point, and then you avoided it by just talking about McDonald's. I said that there's a total difference between an environmental public health problem like air pollution that can only be solved collectively and the private matter of eating too much and not exercising enough.
Can I argue with that?
Yeah.
I think we have to bring the discussion a bit back to science. I don't think there is any evidence that obesity is just only a matter of overeating. I can tell you in the clinic when we see patients, there are some patients who do overeat and they get obese, but a lot of patients who are morbidly obese, they're not necessarily overeating, at least not overeating more than I am actually doing. So when we say that the patients have an individual responsibility because now there is overeating and sedentary lifestyle, I would ask the questions, how many of us are actually non-obese and they're actually overeating and they are not exercising? The fact that we are lucky not to develop obesity doesn't mean that we should judge on those who actually do. So it's not as simple and straightforward. It makes a lot of sense. A lot of problems we have in obesity is that the explanation, the conventional wisdom, that this is all about energy in versus energy out, is all about too many calories and individual decisions to eat too much. It makes sense, it's perfectly logical, except it's scientifically unfunded.
So if we're talking about what government and society can do to stop the obesity epidemic. And you're saying it's not just about overeating, eating a massive pizza every night or anything like that. What can government and society do to respond to the fact that obesity isn't just about overeating? What are the factors that we need to pay more attention to?
I think certainly the government policymaker politicians should require the medical profession to be a bit more precise about what we know and what we don't know. And I think it's also part of our responsibility that we have given a picture of obesity that's too simplistic. And speaking from the perspective of medical doctors and scientists, all the evidence shows that it's not as simple as energy in versus energy out. What happens in the body weight regulation is not physics. It is physics in part, but it's mostly biology. There's a biological...
Genetics?
Biology. Or? There's a biological mechanism that regulates your body weight very, very accurately. So you can increase your number of calories and your body will adjust accordingly. Now, when this mechanism becomes dysfunctional, you develop a disease. And when, of course, the dysfunction is important, you develop severe disease. So thinking that you can fix the problem by just telling people to stop eating is equivalent to telling somebody who has a thyroid gland problem to tell his thyroid to work better. You can't do it.
So what can we do to help those
people? What I
then
think we need to do is, first of all, recognize that there is much more knowledge than we had many years ago, and therefore change our discussion about obesity. So take a little bit of the science that now is available and change those conventional assumptions. But at the same time, recognize that there is not enough knowledge to say we know what is the cause of obesity. I think one of the things government could do is to ask us as a professional and scientists and doctors to be much more precise and potentially fund the research that found the real causes of this problem.
So, Graham, do you think that the government really doesn't have a clue what to do and is at sea far more than actually most of us are about our own diets?
Well, I mean, I agree we need more research, but in the meantime, we have a crisis. We have to do something, and particularly the crisis in type 2 diabetes, which is going to bankrupt the NHS. We know what to do. One is to restrict marketing and advertising of all these junk foods, only allow healthy advertising of food. So why do we stop cigarette advertising when unhealthy foods are a cause of death? So we should stop all unhealthy food being advertised, particularly to children. That's one thing. Secondly, we need to reformulate the food, which we are doing as part of the obesity plan, getting sugar down, getting fat down in these products, like we've done for salt very successfully, slowly reducing it without the public being involved. So it's across the board. So everything you eat will have less sugar in, everything will have less fat, less salt in, and people go on buying the same rubbish but have more healthy food. We need to make sure that children have healthy food at schools and all that whole raft of things there, proper labelling, and we need to use taxes. We have a soft drink levy at the moment with reformulation, which has worked really effectively in getting companies to take the sugar out below 5 grams so they no longer pay the tax. And we need to escalate that tax, and we need to apply that tax to far more unhealthy foods.
Now, if we take a logical step on from advertising, could you not also say that unhealthy food is quite prevalent in our culture? So the Great British Bake Off, for instance, its opening sequence shows a little child by the oven looking excited about eating a cake, and cakes are presented as this sort of family community exciting occasion, whereas actually, I mean, I think they're wonderful, but they are full of all sorts of bad things. And similarly, actually, cooking at home can be very unhealthy. The amount of sugar I put into my tomato soup that I make, for instance, I suspect you'd highly disapprove of. So how can you work on that? Because that's much more subtle, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, I agree with all that. But you have to be in public health, you've got to be practical. Look, you can't get to every family in the country and tell them what to do. What you can do is tell the food industry what to do. And the food industry are very willing to, because of all the publicity, adverse publicity they're getting, they want to reduce the sugar and fat in their foods. Now, I agree, if you take sort of the celebrity chef things, it's what I call heart attack or stroke food or cancer food. You know, it is going to cause you a heart attack if you eat that sort of food.
Which chefs in particular?
Well, you know, all the ones with the double cream, the salt, shoving in the salt like it's sort of...
Nigella Lawson.
Well, I'm not going to get into specific names.
I'm just thinking which recipe books I need to check out.
The BBC saying, why do they promote all these heart attack foods?
And what was the BBC's response?
pretty apathetic, I might say.
Good.
Not surprisingly. But look, it's a separate issue, that. I mean, people watch all these things. They don't actually cook this food most of the time, whereas what they actually eat and what poorer people eat is very cheap hamburgers, takeaways and this sort of stuff. And that's what we're focusing on. And all the processed foods that are very high in sugar, fat and salt. So you will see changes. They're not nearly enough. We need far more, much stronger action to tackle this real crisis that we have, particularly for type 2 diabetes. Remember, it's the biggest cause of blindness, it's the biggest cause of renal dialysis, and the biggest cause of amputation.
And just to draw to a close, Chris, what do you make of the call for so much regulation of advertising?
Well, not just advertising, but also this reformulation to make our food taste like cardboard and make it very expensive. I think it's terrifying. It's a totalitarian approach, a lunatic approach to state control of the food supply, based largely on snobbery. I think that's already been quite clear.
Do you accept that something does need to change, though?
Not really, no. No, I don't. I mean, possibly in schools, anything to do with education, giving kids good schools, teaching them how to cook, I think is good and benign. But the rest of it is extremely damaging. There is no such thing as junk food, by the way. We have a definition called HFSS, which is high in fat, salt, and sugar. And that applies to all sorts of things, not just the takeaways that people always imagine when they hear about junk food, but cheese and bacon and Nigella's, Christmas dishes, cakes, biscuits, all this stuff we're being told is not going to be allowed to advertise. The food industry, the biggest and most important industry in the country, is not going to be allowed to communicate with the customers, not allowed, being allowed to tell people when they have a new product out. It is crazy. And the idea that we should tax people into submission with these taxes, which again will hit the poor hardest, and I find most terrifying, is this food reformulation, this health by stealth approach, which is just going to make things taste worse. And people will notice. Ask LucasAid customers if you don't think people will notice.
That was Christopher Snowden, Professor Graham McGregor and Professor Francesco Rubino. Next, the German election is less than 3 weeks away, but if you believe the polls, the result already looks inevitable. Angela Merkel appears to be heading for yet another victory. The question preoccupying the pundits then is who will come third. In his Spectator article this week, William Cook says whoever does could end up holding the balance of power under Germany's electoral system. So how is the fight for third spot shaping up? And what will the German election mean for Brexit? William Cook joins me along with Henry Newman, who is the director of Open Europe. So Germany's economy is booming. Growth is running at 0.6% per quarter, double the rate of that in the UK. Henry, does this make an Angela Merkel re-election inevitable?
I think it'd be a brave political pundit who said that any election was inevitable after the dislocations of the last few months, referendums and general elections of the UK and so on. But I think, it's looking extraordinarily likely. And the question really is what form of government there is after the election. How does the coalition building process works? Who's in that coalition? Whether we see the right-wing AfD party, which looks very likely, enter the parliament for the first time. And those sort of changes will be more important. And then from the UK point of view, does this change anything at all for Brexit?
William, you've written your piece for The Spectator this week on the German election. There has been a real turnaround from Merkel's plunge in the opinion polls following her decision to let in a million migrants into Germany. So, I mean, this is a surprise still, isn't it? The fact that she's doing so well currently.
Yes, hugely. I mean, this time last year, Alternative for Deutschland, which is the new-ish anti-immigration party, they were polling over 20%. In local elections. It's massive. And they're pushing her party into third place, even in their own backyard in Mecklenburg, where her constituency is. And she really did look like a dead woman walking. I mean, I think two things have turned this around. The first is Trump. And I think what Trump did is it made German voters, or at least that key sort of 10 or 15% of swing German voters, it made them risk averse. They thought, whoa, enough already. There's no room for experiments. There's no room for protest votes. We've got to...
So they weren't inspired by it. They were freaked out by it.
Yeah, they were freaked out about it. And I thought we've got to hunker down here. And actually, I think, especially seeing as Trump was so volatile about foreign policy, about German trade, about NATO as well in particular, I think the German reaction was, whoa, we need the most experienced person in the room here to see us through this crisis, and who's the most experienced person? Angela Merkel.
So it's a case of better the devil you know, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happened with Merkel is there's not kind of rabid enthusiasm for her, but in a way that is a tribute to her success in realigning the CDU. I mean, what Merkel has done with the CDU, which is, we call it the Conservative Party in Germany, but it's actually the Christian Democratic Union. So it's much more traditional and old-fashioned than a Thatcherite Conservative Party. It's more like a Conservative Party from the 50s or the 60s, I would say. And what she's done is she's made it a lot more of a broad church. So people are generally less enthusiastic about her, but she's bringing more people in who say, oh, well, OK, I'll vote CDU then, rather than being fanatical about her.
Now, this is interesting because Theresa May has often been compared to Angela Merkel, although I haven't really heard that since the most recent general election. Henry, you have previously worked for the Conservatives in government. Do you think that our own Prime Minister could learn anything from Angela Merkel's ability to woo voters while not being a spectacular politician?
Well, I think that was the sort of the strategy for the Conservatives going into the election was to argue exactly as William was just saying, that Theresa May was the strong choice, the stable choice in a very difficult time. And obviously it backfired enormously. But I think that if you look at what's happened over the last few months in Germany, if we go back to the sort of spring period where Scholz was obviously going to be the SPD candidate, and it looked like there was a sort of a swelling up of enthusiasm for him. He was a very pro-European figure coming as a obviously from his background in the European Parliament. And it looked suddenly as if the mood was changing. But Merkel's been quite clever, despite her sort of caution and her stable and boring image, to actually shift the ground in some key areas. For example, allowing a vote on same-sex marriage, she's actually rather shot the fox of the left. And equally, on the big question of immigration and the migrant refugee issue, it's quite hard for the left, who's broadly pro-migration, to attack her on that question. And what they basically said is that you should have consulted more with your European colleagues. Well, fine, but that's not a sort of a fundamental questioning of her policy. So I think actually she's been quite careful to sort of shift slowly. And she's a very, very experienced politician. This is somebody who's been leader of the CDU since 2000 and has been chancellor since 2005. If she, as we all assume, continues to be chancellor after this election, she'll be one of the longest serving leaders in any democracy, I would think.
William, what sort of state is the left in Germany in at the moment?
Well, I think they're in a state of dramatic anticlimax. As Henry said, when Martin Schulz came in, there were high hopes for him. And when he became leader in March and he came in on a huge sort of groundswell of popular support, he's a bit of a bogeyman here in Britain because of his EU associations. But in Germany, he really does have the common touch. He's not one of these people with two doctorates. He started off working in a bookshop after he'd sort of had a sort of tried and failed to become a professional footballer. He is dreadful tag, a bit of a man of the people. And so I think they had high hopes that he would bring them forward. It hasn't happened for a couple of reasons. One is my sources have told me that it's actually a problem for him that he's not in the Bundestag. He doesn't have a natural platform there. He has to sort of create an opportunity to get in the papers, and he doesn't have a stage. But the biggest problem, I think, is the fear of a red-red coalition, i.e. a coalition between the SPD, who are soft left, and the breakaway left-wing party who split from the SPD after Schroeder's Labour reforms, which is Die Linke, literally the left. And voters have become very wary of the idea that these two parties might form a coalition. Before, this was absolutely taboo for the SPD. They would not countenance it. And what's changed in the last few years is, for the first time, the SPD and Die Linke in several places, most notably in Berlin, have got together in coalitions. And I think soft left voters are thinking, whoa, enough already. I don't want to see the SPD teaming up with former communists.
Right, so this sounds a little bit like the Lib Dems in this country. Is Martin Schulz the new Nick Clegg, Henry?
I wouldn't go that. I think what was interesting, if we go back to the television debates that happened between Merkel and Scholz, it was a very bizarre debate. Merkel obviously did bite the bullet by actually agreeing to do a debate, which obviously Theresa May dodged during this general election. But it was a very stilted format. There were four presenters and only the two of them on stage. And they spent a lot of the time agreeing with one another. So, I mean, there was a bit of the sort of shades of 2010 general election debate in the UK, where Gordon Brown kept agreeing with Nick. But that this was from the main challenger kept agreeing with the incumbent and so on. I think that was it spoke to the consensual nature of politics in Germany, but also the fact that because of the electoral system which the Allies bequeathed after the Second World War, Germany is almost bound permanently into coalitions. And that means it's very hard for a coalition partner, as we've seen with the Liberal Democrats, to then stand on a separate platform and define themselves politically.
So if AfD have a successful election, what effect will this have on German politics?
Well, it's going to be very peculiar. At the moment, nobody will work with AfD, and I can't see that changing anytime soon. So basically, the bigger a vote they get and the more seats they get, the more of embarrassment it's going to be for everyone and for German democracy at large. You're going to have a kind of cuckoo in the nest, a party there that nobody will deal with, nobody will have anything to do with. But the key thing here is, I know it sounds a bit dreary in an election campaign to say, oh, I wonder who's going to come third. But I think, as Henry said, with the PR system that you have in Germany, this is really key. Mm. Because normally the third party would be the kingmakers. They would team up with the first party and form a coalition, normally. But nobody will work with AfD. So if AfD come third, it's going to be very embarrassing for everyone.
And what will the election mean for the Brexit talks, Henry?
So I don't think it'll actually mean that much. I think that obviously the elections are hugely significant in Germany. This is the 27s and Europe's one of Europe's biggest powers, obviously, so the world's biggest power. So I think it's a very significant event. Equally, we're all expecting, bar some big upset, that Angela Merkel will be returned. But I think for in terms of Brexit, what it does mean is that obviously the Chancellor's personal attention has been diverted for some time. And also she's been presumably wary about making significant moves that might have an electoral effect within Germany regarding Europe more generally. But I wouldn't say that Brexit is anything of a significant issue inside Germany. It didn't feature in the recent televised debate between the two principals that I just referred to. But I think what we can expect is that in the aftermath of the election, there'll be a process of coalition building, whoever is elected. And then it'll be really after that that things get restarted again. But if we go back to the sort of the importance of Germany, I think Cameron spent an enormous amount of time, and this is all detailed in Craig Oliver's texts from his time in Downing Street, spent a lot of time trying to woo Merkel and encourage her to hear his position. I think there's a real danger that Theresa May or the Conservatives in general spend too much time thinking about what Germany might buy them.
I think Henry's absolutely right there. I mean, I think as far as Germany's concerned, Brexit's done, it's over, it's a matter for the European Commission, and they're looking forward and looking elsewhere. And Germany has 9 land borders with 9 other countries, and those trucks running in and out of Germany every day, they're going to those countries first. That's their paramount concern. I do think there's going to be a big change depending on whether Angela Merkel wins big or wins small. If she wins small, she has to go back into a so-called grand coalition with the SPD. And this really makes it hard for anybody to get anything done. You've got centre-right and centre-left and kind of cancelling each other out. If she wins big, however, she can either form a coalition with the Greens, which might be quite attractive for both the CDU and the Green Party. They're not as far apart as the equivalent parties might be in Britain. Or she could form a coalition with the Free Democrats, who are kind of classical liberals, orange book liberals, if you like. And that might also be more attractive for our ideas of what German trade might be. That would be a boost for German trade and hopefully for British trade as well.
That was William Cook and Henry Newman.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
And finally, English football is down in the dumps, says Rod Liddle. Having been knocked out of the European Championships last year by Iceland, the Three Lions are now struggling to overcome the likes of Malta in qualifying for next year's World Cup. So what's going wrong? And is Rod right to argue that England's current top crop of footballers are a load of rubbish? Toby Young and The Spectator's deputy editor Freddie Gray have their say. So Freddie, why are England still struggling against small teams?
Well, I mean, I share with Rod the sort of disillusionment about English football. I've felt it for a long time. But I do think that actually smaller minnow nations, footballing nations, are producing much better sides, and that should be borne in mind. I mean, France just failed to beat Luxembourg, which is extraordinary, given the amount of talent the French side has. So I think the one of the main factors which Rod admits is that these nations are getting a lot better. And actually, no matter how small your population is, within reason, and you know, San Marino are never going to win the World Cup, but that if you can get 11 fit players against a team that doesn't play regularly together and who aren't completely hopeless, you can actually have quite a reasonably good football match.
So, Toby, it's actually about the demands that we're placing on English players, or not enough demands, it sounds like, in terms of training and in terms of working as a team.
Yes, I mean, it's always a bit mysterious to me as to why the England football team aren't better, given our resources, given our size and so forth. But actually, I thought the performance against Slovakia wasn't bad, having actually travelled to Israel in 2007 to watch England in a play against Israel. And it was, I travelled all the way to Israel, and it was a dismal no-score draw.
Well, Toby and I are both QPR fans, so I guess we know about misery and trying to find hope.
This was like QPR Millwall on a rainy Tuesday night, in which neither side scored. And we then didn't qualify for the 2008 Euros, and Steve McClaren was binned as a result. So compared to that, England's performance against Slovakia was it was like watching Brazil in the 1970 World Cup. I agree, their performances generally are disappointing. On the way to that match in Israel, I sat next to Glenn Hoddle, the England manager who was sacked following some impolitic remarks about reincarnation, and is now a regular commentator, and said, is it true that these players don't play as hard, don't put in as much effort, worry about injuries and so forth when they play for the international side, when they play in these international games compared to when they play for their club side? I said, no, that's just complete nonsense. They try their socks off. They're proud of being English. They do their best for their country. I won't hear that. I just won't hear it. It certainly seems that way.
Freddie, do you agree with that? Or do you think that actually playing for a football club in England at the moment is just much more prestigious? It's where the effort is put into, and actually the hold that the clubs have over their English players, what few English players they have, is much greater.
I think undoubtedly. I mean, the Premier League and other top-level football, club football, is swallowing up the international game. I mean, you don't have to be very perceptive or know a lot about football to see that players don't really care that much about most international fixtures. They do at the World Cup, but not anything else really.
Why is that? Is that because there's more money in club football?
I think it's because club football is huge. There's more money, there's much more attention on it. People really care about it in a way that they are caring about international football less and less. I think that may be changing a little bit. And I think one of the good things about this England squad is that there is a slight sense of unity and some sort of commitment there. And Southgate, even though I agree with Rod, he's not a very good manager. He isn't a disaster, I think, in the way that, say, Steve McClaren was.
Toby, isn't it more pragmatic, actually, to care about international football less when your country doesn't do very well at international football, so you might as well invest all your emotional energy in QPR?
Well, I'm not sure anyone would recommend that as a wise investment. I think it's difficult not to want your country to do well and not to get excited by these tournaments. However often you've been disappointed before, there are a couple of bright spots. The women's England football team generally does a lot better than the men's. And the England under-20 squad actually won the under-20 World Cup this year, beating Venezuela in the final. That doesn't necessarily mean that we've got a kind of host of great players coming up through the youth system, because we did pretty well in the 1993 under-20 World Cup. I think we came third, and that team didn't really kick on. Gareth Southgate managed the under-21 squad before he became the England manager, and he got them through to the qualifying stages of the European under-21 championship in 2015, and then we came bottom of our group in the group stages. And it feels as though that's what's going to happen next year.
Let's talk about women's football quickly. Actually, just the England women's team made it to the semi-finals of this summer's European Championships. Obviously, maybe we should just start cheering them on instead and forget about the men. But is it the case that actually the culture in women's football is much more geared towards international football because there's less complacency about English women's football than there is about English men's football?
I think, yes, you're right, that at the international level, women's football is quite interesting and quite good, whereas at the club level, it hasn't really taken off.
Yeah. Do you think that's because there are fewer prima donnas in the women's squad than there are in the men's squad, or is it because there aren't enough leaders in the men's squad that we actually aren't doing better?
I do think England has a leaders problem, and what's funny about the current England team, the current England men's team, is that we still associate English players with sort of grit and toughness, and actually that's really not the case. If you look at our team, our real problem is we do not have a fast defensive central midfielder, and what we do have is very talented but slightly erratic attacking players like Dele Alli and Rashford.
And Toby, even though the clubs are the most powerful forces in
football. They don't seem to be developing their players at grassroots level to be developing young English male players. Is that a fair assessment from someone who pays no attention to football at all?
I think that is fair. I mean, if you look at the under 20 England squad who won the under 20 World Cup this year, not nearly enough of them are getting regular first team football. And, you know, they're good enough to beat the best in the world at that level. So why aren't they getting more first team football?
And our academy is way behind. I mean, we do have more of a, what they love to call, football people love to call, a technical focus on talent in our academies and footballing schools. But that's something that the French and the Spanish have been doing for maybe 10, 20 years further. So maybe in 10, 20 years' time, we'll see a similar level of talent coming out of England. But
so
we're way behind.
So it could be a long-term supply problem.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
That was Toby Young and Freddie Gray. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast hosted by Damien Thompson and Christina Odoni. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this podcast, as well as great pieces by Lara Prendergast, James Dellingpole and Sarah Vine. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening and do join us again next week.